is time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
Welcome to another Viewpoint This Sunday. This is Malcolm Out Loud. Well, I've dubbed this one The Tale of Two Countries, and it's become very clear that we have two ideologies, two thought processes, and I'm seeing a lot of telltale signs. It's a big moment for our country, and there certainly is a lot to discuss here, starting with the Supreme Court, and everybody's eyes and thoughts and hope were based on the Supreme Court, and we see the ruling has not turned out in favor of the MAGA movement and of President Trump and millions of Americans. Let's take that story on now with Dinesh D'Souza. Dinesh is an author, filmmaker, a storyteller of truth, I always say, but mostly Dinesh is an American patriot and certainly one of the great conservative voices out there in today's political landscape. So the president tweeted on this and said, Justices Alito and Thomas say they would have allowed Texas to proceed with its election lawsuit. And he goes on to say that people of the United States were cheated and our country disgraced, never even given our day in court. What's interesting about this, Dinesh, is that Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett were silent in the decision, and yet Alito and Thomas, and that would have tipped it over. They would have had a ruling that would have allowed this to at least go forward and be heard. What did you make of this?
There's a lot of frustration, demoralization, and anger. Because there was a lot of energy behind the Texas suit. All these other states were beginning to jump in. I believe 100 Republican members of Congress climbed aboard. So this was looking to be the forum for making the case and airing the grievance. And it is a real grievance. This is not a case where one side lost an election and is refusing to accept the outcome. That was the case in 2016 when Trump won and the other side wouldn't accept the outcome. But this is a case where one side feels cheated. They're a little bit in the position of the battered wife who's now being asked to sort of put on the sunglasses and move on. You really can't move on. You need at the very least to have your day in court. Now, in a way, people are angry with the Supreme Court and saying, well, they didn't even let us make our case. It would have been worse if they let us make our case and go and said there's no case. That's not what they said. What they basically said is you're the wrong person to bring this suit. So it's a procedural argument. They're saying that ultimately, it's not quite saying what happens in Georgia stays in Georgia, but what they're saying is that if there's a grievance in Georgia or about Georgia, it has to come from Georgia.
You know, this was one I really thought did have some legs to it for the reasons you just mentioned. Not only was the momentum of everybody in there, but here's the argument I put forth on this, Dinesh. We are called the United States of America. What I'm not understanding myself, and maybe you can help me clear it up, but how can the Supreme Court say that it doesn't impact another state or they don't have jurisdiction to bring this particular case when really we're talking about the presidency of all 50 states? And to me, I think that's why I thought there was some merit to this and it would be heard. I was quite frankly shocked that they dismissed this in the way that they did. Obviously, there was some thought process behind Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett to go that way. But do I have a point? I mean, aren't we the United States of America? Doesn't this have a part? I mean, aren't we all sort of going to be impacted by this decision?
Unquestionably. I mean, there's no one is even saying that Biden is going to be the president only of Pennsylvania and Georgia and Michigan. He's obviously the president of the whole country. That's what's at stake. And so it makes no sense at all to say that this is not something that affects Texas. Now, it could be that the Supreme Court isn't really saying that. What they might be saying is, look, there is a process in the Constitution which lays out the pact among the states. And this process calls upon the state legislatures of each state to have the responsibility for making sure that the elections in their state are fair and how their electors are picked. And so by this logic, it opens up a Pandora's box to let one state become the supervisory authority over another state. So the Supreme Court could be saying, listen, the way that we carry this out is that ultimately, we need Georgia lawsuits demonstrating fraud in Georgia. We can't have Texas saying Georgia didn't do it right, because that's ultimately that's a process that leads to no end. Every state is going to contest the practices of another state and go and demand that the Supreme Court intervene, because the, supposedly this has some impact on all the other states as well.
You know, we have 50 different election systems, basically, because of the state legislatures and how they set up their systems in each state, which I also think we were set up for failure also. And we really do need some sort of a United States plan of action here for our election systems. Don't we need to redesign our election systems after this thing? It's been a debacle.
Well, I think we do. But I think what the Supreme Court is telling us, you know, they have their own weird way of communicating, because they don't say things explicitly. They just say things like request denied. And you got to now read what the Supreme Court is telegraphing to us. But I think what they're saying to us, and in a pretty decisive majority, you remember all the three Trump nominees or Trump appointees to the court were on the other side of this. Interestingly, Alito and Tom, the two Trump conservatives, on the Supreme Court. So what the Supreme Court seems to be saying is that there is a job, but it's going to have to be done at the state level. And I think this is a this is something Republicans have not paid enough attention to. It's almost like in the 2020 election, we focused on the campaign and they focused on the election. And what I mean is, we focused on get out the vote, let's do rallies, let's motivate the troops, let's make the case. And they didn't even bother to campaign. I mean, Biden was basically, you know, checking out by noon every morning and having rallies with like seven people in them. But they were focused on things like, let's make sure we litigate to get all these mail-in ballots out, and let's organize the counting so that the observers are kept a safe distance away. So we sort of tried to manage, you may say, the campaign, and they sought to manage the election.
Yeah, that's really well said. They managed the whole procedure, and which was really put them in a position to do some of the things that they've done here. So let me ask you this now. Let's talk about the state legislatures. There's a lot of talk about, again, they have a responsibility to the states to ensure that the elections are done lawfully, fairly, that sort of thing. That's how the election system is supposed to work. Electoral College is going to meet here on Monday. Or that's supposed to happen. So, you know, we're running against a clock problem, more or less. But there's a lot of people pinning hope on these state legislatures that somehow they're going to vote and go against the will of the people, or so, at least the will of the documented people in those states. Is there any possibilities to that, Dinesh?
Well, the great irony is that in all these swing states, Republicans are in the majority. Exactly. So it is not an exaggeration to say that this election in that sense is in the hands of the GOP. Now, had the Democrats, had the two parties been switched, I think it is very clear that Democratic nominees to the court would have definitely delivered the election for the Democrat. Mm. And similarly, democratically controlled state legislatures would deliver the election for the Democrat. But this really shows the difference in psychology between the two parties. Republicans are the party of the nice guys, or the straight-laced people, are following the process. And there's a lot of Republicans who are like, well, you know, this is the process. You know, we're very reluctant to sort of call thing into question. So there's a sort of not apathy, it's not quite the right word, because there's an element of fear involved. I think the Republicans are scared of the media. They're scared of the left. They're scared of the recriminations against themselves and public doxing and the naming of their children and intimidation. So the left has introduced all these threatening elements in the culture. Digital censorship is only one of them. And I think all of this is combining to create an atmosphere in which it becomes very difficult for Republican state legislators to say, okay, you know what? I honestly believe there was fraud. I'm not going to certify the electors.
Don't they always say also, though, to your point there, that nice guys finish last?
They do. And I think it is now dawning on our side the degree to which the other side has become both corrupt and gangsterized. we begin to realize that our ordinary tactics of ordinary politics, things like, you know, an Antifa guy breaks a window and we write a strongly worded op-ed calling for civility, that is not appropriate to the situation. You actually have to grab the Antifa guy. I don't mean you and I have to, but the cops have to. Mm-hmm. Because when that guy's looking at a year in prison, then all his buddies and comrades go, listen, it's not good to break windows. We better go home back to mom's basement. But as long as they feel they can get away with it, that there's no accountability, they're going to keep doing it.
Listen to this next point here, Dinesh. Texas GOP Chair Alan West. So he says SCOTUS setback may call for a new union of law-abiding states. Now, let me be clear. There's been a fair amount of conversation about civil wars and red and blue Americas and all of that over the past several years. And we've seen that building and build into a bit of a crescendo moment here. So Alan West now is the leader of the Republican Party in Texas. And he come right out with this, these comments he put out there. And then it was followed up. Representative Kyle Binderman there of Texas, his state representative there, says the federal government is out of control and does not represent the values of Texans. That is why I am committed to file legislation this session that will allow a referendum to give Texans a vote for the state of Texas to reassert its status as an independent nation. Now, that's not the first time Texas has come up with that theory. Radio host Rush Limbaugh, same thing. He said, I actually think, and I've referenced this, he says, I've alluded to this a couple of times because I've seen others allude to this. I actually think we're trending toward secession, he says. And he said, it can't go on this way. He said, there cannot be a peaceful coexistence of two completely different theories of life, theories of government, theories of how we manage our affairs. We can't be in this dire conflict without something given somewhere along the way. Now, I think you have a sense. I know you have a sense of the structural damage of these two ideologies, and we're tearing apart each other, the fabric of our country, in ways that I've never seen in my lifetime. What do you make of all this? Is this all just cheap talk, or is there something brewing here on the underside?
Well, I think that there is. There is something brewing behind it. Let's explore the psychology of what would cause Alan West and many others to start saying that. Number one, there has been a secession of the American mind, which is to say, I think that the two sides in this country really no longer see each other as full fellow citizens. That kind of the ties of sort of comradeship that typically need to bind people together in a democracy. Democracy isn't just a matter of the side with the most votes gets to bully and dominate and control the other side. We live in a regime of majority rule, but minority rights. And when your rights are threatened, then you may say the deal is off. People don't feel psychologically bound into the contract. Now, obviously, secession poses insuperable difficulties. We have the history of the Civil War. Obviously, we are not the party of the Confederacy. But it is also true that even Lincoln admitted, one of the interesting themes of Lincoln's first inaugural is he says to the South, hey, you claim that your constitutional rights have been violated. And in effect, I'm obviously paraphrasing it. Lincoln goes, well, name them. What rights of yours have I violated? Lincoln is basically saying, have I violated your right to free speech? Have I violated your right to assemble? Have I violated your right to vote? No. But the implication of Lincoln's statement is that if I did, you would have a point. If I did, you would have a constitutional grievance. But Lincoln, of course, insisted that he had not violated those rights. But I think today, many of us fear and in fact observe that those rights, are being violated, and that the Democrats are encroaching upon our basic constitutional liberties, from free speech to freedom of religion. So I think this is the psychology behind the sense that, well, listen, you know, we don't think that Biden is going to be a president for the whole country. He's not going to look out for our interests. In fact, he's going to look out for ways to undermine our interests. So to that degree, we have a serious problem.
Yeah, and we're headed somewhere, I think we all agree, and we don't really know where that is going to be, where the destination is, but it's created a lot of unrest out there. I think people can feel it. The news cycle is is as strange as it ever has been, I think. So I want to talk about strange now. Good segue here to Representative Eric Swalwell. His relationship with the suspected Chinese spy Feng Fang. The New York Post reports that Swalwell has refused to confirm or deny whether he had a romantic relationship with the woman, also known as Christine Fang, who's suspected of sleeping with at least two Midwest mayors as part of her espionage work from China. Of course, this thing, we know there are a lot of Chinese spies throughout our country. We've seen the Houston consulate closed down, but that's just the tip of nothing. I mean, there's so much to this story. It's unbelievable. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, she, in her lunacy mode that she is consistently in, say she gives a vote of confidence to Swalwell after these revelations come up, Dinesh, and with the Chinese spy. And then here's the drum roll comment, Dinesh, that she says, I don't have any concern about Mr. Swalwell. I do think that it is unfortunate that Mr. McCarthy, the House Minority Leader now, is trying to make an issue of this. Well, I nearly passed out on the floor when she said that, because Pelosi has made an issue out of everything that was not even remotely an issue. And she's worried that this is being made into an issue, the fact that he's sleeping with a Chinese spy. And how do you make this stuff up? Huh?
Well, I think it shows, number one, it shows how the Democrats hang together and they protect their own side. Republicans in general don't. The second thing it shows is that the Democrats are okay with foreign intervention in American politics. All their stuff about Russia collusion was merely a tactical strike against Trump. In fact, there's considerable, not only Chinese, but radical Islamic intervention in U.S. politics. And I'm talking about not just the funding of political campaigns at the national and local level, but also the funding of think tanks, the funding of media organizations, funding going to the Columbia Journalism School. So you've got these institutions in America that are very influential and that are the way in which information gets out to people. And they are, at least you may say, contaminated, if not compromised, by foreign influence. So this is a real problem going forward. But these foreign actors recognize that it's the Democratic Party that is the transmission belt for this influence to be carried out.
Yeah, and there are a lot of cries right now to change the style in how we invite these Chinese students and young folks in, not just at our universities, but in our political offices throughout Congress as well. It looks like something's going to have to give there, Dinesh, because this is sort of a suicide pact if we don't. I mean, China is clearly our biggest adversary. I think something's going to have to give there, don't you think?
Yes. I think it's my wife is from Venezuela and she's kind of lived out this script and she's disheartened because she feels that America is going that way. What happened in Venezuela, by the way, was that once the Chavistas began to rig the election, the right, the conservatives, began to fracture. They began to attack each other. They began to become even more divided. In fact, the main opposition party splintered into multiple parties. And so Debbie, looks around here and she sees people talking now about, well, let's start a third party, a Patriots party. And of course, this would be a recipe for weakening our side, because American politics is fought in teams. And there's really just two teams. Now, the Republican Party was a new team on the block in 1854, but it replaced the Whig Party. If you had a Democratic Party, a Whig Party, and a Republican Party, the Republicans would surely have lost the 1860 election.
What a great example that is that you put out there with Debbie D'Souza. I mean, it's a perfect example of Venezuela saying what happens. It should scare the hell out of everybody, what we're talking about right now, because the telltale signs are frightening at this very, very moment here. Staying with the China thing, and Dinesh, talk a minute about Hunter Biden. Trump put a tweet out, if Biden gets in, nothing will happen to Hunter or Joe. Barr will do nothing, and the new group of partisan killers coming in will quickly kill it all. Same thing with Durham. We caught them cold, spying, treason, and more. But justice took too long. We'll be DOA. So he's talking about a Biden presidency. You know, I got thinking the other day, somebody asked me, Dinesh, well, what happens with Hunter Biden? This story's now blowing up because the media can't stop it. And so will he just pardon his son? Well, the power of the president is he can pardon anybody. I mean, surely he can pardon his son or pardon his great grandfather three times removed if he wants. But let me go further with this. Todd Starnes, a radio host there, that the president retweeted as well. If the Wall Street Journal story is true and Attorney General Barr knew in the spring about the Biden investigation and kept it quiet, he should be fired by the end of business today. Trump retweeted that and said a big disappointment, saying he's seen all this, but he's sort of handcuffed a little bit with what he's doing or not going to do. And finally, one last thought. Representative Steve Scalise, Dinesh, says, let's be clear about what happened. Big tech censored the Biden corruption story. The media called it Russian disinformation, all to protect Joe Biden in the election. Now the truth is out. Hunter Biden is under federal investigation. The New York Post and Bobulinski were right. You know, Dinesh, I have to tell you, you see the stories about the brother. You see the stories about the family. You see the stories about the son. And then they say, well, what about Joe Biden? Is he under investigation? I mean, stands to reason he can't be clean with all this dirt. What do you think of this?
Well, this is a case where the media suppressed the Biden story before the election, but are now airing it. And this is not because it has somehow broken loose and they can't control it, because they controlled it very well beforehand, even though there was smoking gun evidence from Hunter Biden's laptop, from Bobulinski, who was a business partner. They were able to suppress it. So let's ask why they're releasing it now. It isn't just because the election is over and they think that their guy won. I think in a way they're paving the way to get rid of Biden. It's almost as if they recognize that Biden was the useful idiot that they needed to get across the finish line. And once they got him across the finish line, their plan has always been, how do we now, as quickly as possible, get rid of this guy so we can bring Kamala Harris into the Oval Office? So I think that could be an explanation for what's going on. At least it explains the demented psychology of the media. And it also shows that our media is now made up of political operatives. They're not a real media in the sense they're not giving us honest information. And it puts us in a very awkward situation as a country because we're reliant on information bringers. It's kind of like in the old days, you're reliant on the King's Herald to tell you what's going on, but he's not telling you 1 ounce of truth.
It is frightening, Dinesh. In our final thoughts here, help me put this in a big package now for people to understand. Yesterday, President Trump put out a tweet after all of this had happened that we just talked about, Dinesh, everything that we've just discussed. People are saying, well, is he defeated? What's he going to do? How's it going to happen? How will he leave the office? Will he be in Marine One? Will he be to the inauguration for Biden? All these questions are being asked. He sends a tweet out Saturday, says in all capital letters, Dinesh, he says, we have just begun to fight. Now, you talk all the time about Donald Trump and his characteristics of being a fighter. What do you make of all that? What's the next move?
Number one, I don't think that Trump is going to kind of be a, quote, nice guy and simply go through the rituals of concession. The reason that he won't, and in my opinion, shouldn't, is because this was an election riddled with shenanigans, organized shenanigans. If you listen to the testimony of all the in all the different states, there was a chilling similarity to it. Because why? Because someone was organizing this. It was being coordinated. I don't know if the machines themselves were involved, but there certainly were people involved, and quite a few of them. For all these reasons, I think this whole idea that we should gracefully submit, I don't think Trump is going to do it, and neither are the Trump voters. Now, when Trump says we're going to fight on, he could mean this in two senses. He can mean we're going to exhaust every approach legally this time, but we're going to fight on in the longer term too. And that means that Trump is going to, who knows, start a network, be active in politics, run again, continue to expand and build his base. I mean, he remains, I think, the key player in the Republican Party without a doubt. And therefore, he might mean fight on in the broader sense, because it's looking to me difficult at this stage to see a pathway for Trump to retain the presidency, given what the Supreme Court has decided, given the relative kind of timidity of the state legislatures. It's not clear for me where the pathway is right now.
I seen a message, Dinesh, that said, listen to this, you'll love this. Keep in mind, we haven't even used the Trump card, which, of course, was the name of your film and So I thought of you immediately. Oh, Trump card, there it is. And this person goes on to say the Hunter Biden laptop, declassified, the Wiener laptop, Seth Ridge, Julian Assange, Obamagate, SEAL Team 6, Epstein Files, Uranium 1, Benghazi 9/11. They're talking about declassifying everything here. There's talk about Trump declassifying files or kind of setting the place on fire when he leaves. And, you know, which I think a lot of Americans would stand tall and applaud that move. What do you say to that as a final thought, Dinesh?
Well, the declassification, I think, is the most important legacies of the Trump presidency, is it has exposed us all to all this bad stuff that's been going on behind closed doors in the government. And we would never have known about it were it not for Trump. So he's right. They are going to try to shut the door on all this again. So I think that sunlight is a very good thing here. This is not the equivalent of setting the place on fire. No, I don't think he should put, you know, glue in the desks and make it and throw away the keys to all the locked cabinets and so on. So he shouldn't sabotage the administration. That's not what we're about. But declassification is something different altogether. It's showing the American public, look at all this bad stuff that has that is being done and has been done in your name.
Or he could also just remove the B, as in boy, from the keynotes of the computers, such as they did with W, with Bush.
Yeah, I know, I know. Well, you know, Trump is a fighter, but I think he's also a man of law, and he will pursue every legal remedy. And if and when legal remedies are exhausted, it's time to come up with a new and different plan.
The stories we're talking about are so important, people, that we dig a little deeper and we understand what's really behind that story. You know, it's one thing to just look at headlines all day long and spit narratives out, as a lot of the political talking pundits' heads do, but it's one of the enjoyable things about Dinesh D'Souza. So, well, listen, we're talking about the tale of two countries. A lot more to talk about. That also plays into the COVID. And you see also what's going on up in New York. Pretty bad stuff there. Got some interesting storylines there for you today as well. A lot more about the election here. Let's take a pause. We'll be back with more Viewpoint in just a moment.
We are the vision of the voices. You can email us at talk@americaoutloud.com.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
President Trump's tweet, "We have just begun to fight." He has really transformed the party in many, many ways. But the question is, with this election, are people ready to give in yet? Or what does that really mean when we say we've just begun to fight? Let's pick that up now and bring on, for the first time, excited to have on, Mary Fanning is here. She's an investigative journalist, a cover of national security. She's been on the front lines of a lot of this, I guess I'd call it electronic warfare with the election, the digital that's being exposed, that part of the equation. There was so much questionable, let's put it that way, with the election here. Mary, we're running out of doors to open at this point, and the Electoral College, of course, is going to be meeting here now. We're on the doorsteps of that. What's your takeaway in the big picture of the election and what is left to fight with that's in the arsenal, Mary?
For starters, the Supreme Court weighed in and said that Texas did not have standing. That does not mean that the other states do not have standing, by the way. What we're looking at really is cyber warfare. We have, you know, foreign actors, adversaries who are in our election, China, Russia, Iran, Venezuela. We also have Canada in our election through Dominion. And we know that they were using Dominion to steal votes we also, so, you know, we put out a piece on October 31st before the election, and we told that the vote would be stolen. We named the states, Pennsylvania, Texas, Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, Nevada, and Arizona. Florida was included. Dennis Montgomery, the CIA whistleblower, came forward to tell us that those states were being stolen via a prismatic scoring algorithm known as Scorecard. Now, this is an application that works off of Hammer. This is important to understand because Hammer had been a foreign surveillance tool. Montgomery created it in 2003. On February 3rd, 2009, John Brennan and James Clapper illegally commandeered and stole this powerful system and moved it to Fort Washington. They took control, personal control, of a foreign surveillance tool and turned it on America. Through that, they are able to steal elections with the application known as Scorecard. They were using it. They were stealing votes. You have to see that it's, when you see identical blocks of votes across these states, it is proof positive that they were stealing massive numbers of votes, but that they could not keep up with the landslide of Donald Trump's win. And so, as most people are probably aware at this point, we saw at 4 o'clock in the morning, 112,000 votes all of a sudden show up in Wisconsin in one block. These are identical blocks of votes. 112,000 of those votes went to Joe Biden. The same thing happened in Michigan, 135,000 blocks of votes, identical right. votes, all for Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm. Why isn't there any more on this? I mean, we see what's happened here. There's been a lot of talk about the digital application of this, and a lot of people are shaking their heads. For instance, you mentioned back in 03 and then 09 and Brennan Clapper, and we see Brennan Clapper and Comey have been up to a lot of mischief in our nation. But why isn't that story initially, that seed of the story about the taking of that from the CIA and what had taken place, why hasn't that ever been out in the light of day? Why is it being so held back and censored? So I don't, it's a major story if it's accurate. Why, what's the deal with that?
It is accurate. And well, there's a couple of reasons why. One is that Hammer is an SAP program, and who comes out and speaks to this program is charged with treason if they're read in. Beyond that, very few people are read in. This initially was a Department of Defense tool run by the DIA. Who was in charge of the DIA at one point? Well, that was General Flynn. This will tell you, this is one of the reasons that they wanted General Flynn muzzled.
But as far as any of the media and any of the journalists, and nobody wanted to touch this story back then.
No one will touch this story because you've got the Mockingbird media mm-hmm. working with the Democrat Party mm-hmm. who are attempting to take over this country with radicals. And you have an assist by the likes of our, you know, CIA Director John Brennan, who right. is a communist, you know, who stood, he's not just a communist himself. He's from a long line of communists. His family, father and grandfather were with the IRA. The IRA was run by the Soviets and armed by Andropov, and they were trained in Moscow. This is not just a small story.
Well, it's hard for people to wrap their minds around a lot of this, clearly. Let me ask you this. With the digital application of the votes changing, there's been a lot of talk about the night of the election on what happened on the 3rd and the 4th here. From the digital component again, the cyber warfare element of this particular election. And again, there are a lot of there's a lot of pieces to this election as to what possibly and potentially happened. But why isn't that piece now hit the light of day to the point where anybody has picked it up? Like, if it's really provable that we look at it, Mary, and why isn't the president really on that part of it? And you see where I'm at? Why are they not on this?
Well, they are speaking to it. But right now, you know, yeah. let me take your focus to Ameren County in Michigan, okay. where they first discovered that the Dominion was stealing the votes. In Ameren County, they found, they did a forensic audit. The Attorney General, Dana Nessel, said, no, you're not allowed to see that. You're forbidden to see mm-hmm. that forensic audit.
When we talk about the things we're talking and we're laying out, Mary, here, it begins to sound like really a spy thriller, a very interesting piece that somebody has put together because it's so out there, the story. And bring it back all the way back to 03 and the CIA and the 09 and the Brennan and the Clapper and what's happened. And from what I understand, this has happened before this election, right? I mean, I think I've heard they've used this in other elections. Is that correct?
And Dennis Montgomery told, and also the whistleblower tapes, which we published, told. They came out of federal judge G. Murray Snow's courtroom. They were not supposed to be made public. They became public and they revealed quite a bit. And they told that the 2012 election was stolen by Brennan and Clapper. They told exactly how Brennan and Clapper stole the election using scorecard, this prismatic scoring algorithm, to steal the vote. It steals the votes at the transfer points as they leave the Secretary of State's office and enter the internet. At that point, scorecard steals the vote.
What does President Donald Trump know or not know about this? And Trump does not hide secrets when it comes to these kinds of things. Why hasn't he got to the airwaves? I mean, this would be a big game changer if this was that. Why hasn't there been a moment or some sort of a, you know, whatever it is, a speech to the nation? Maybe it's time to have one of those fireside chats and tell America what the hell is going on. Why hasn't anything like that happened, Mary?
I'm not certain why that hasn't happened, but his attorneys are doing things on the ground. Beyond which, it's really important to understand the executive order that he put forth in 2018, talking about stealing the vote. He addressed that and what the remedies were to be. It's laid out very clearly in his executive order, and the stolen vote will not stand.
But you almost think the generals could get the attention of the president and say, Mr. President, we have a real problem here. We need to talk. This is what I don't understand. See, for me as a CEO and spending my life in boardrooms, you know, when you had a problem, Mary, you got in the boardroom and you hammered it out or you figured it out or you did something, but you fixed it. This is where I have a hard time wrestling with this. And there's that point, Mary. And then how do we convince more millions of Americans that this is a real deal? This is a conspiracy to really create a hostile act and do some damage to the country. It is not just a theory, but it's actually happening. How do we, you know, people, they see this and they don't believe it because it sounds really out there, doesn't it?
Well, you may think it sounds out there, but you saw Sidney Powell on Lou Dobbs and Maria Bartiromo and Liz McDonald on Fox.
Yeah.
And, you know, she addressed scorecard and hammer specifically, but also she submitted an affidavit from Dr. Naveed Kasharv Nia. Mm-hmm. He was a cybersecurity expert who worked for the CIA, the DID, the DIA, the Department of Defense. And his affidavit swore to the existence of scorecard and hammer.
Mm-hmm.
So the American people have stood up, and yesterday in Washington, D.C., there was a massive march against the stolen vote, the Jericho March. So the American people are standing up against this. But as far as scorecard and hammer, there's proof positive. Dennis Montgomery received two immunity agreements from the FBI and the Department of Justice. He handed over 47 hard drives of evidence to them. He handed over they demanded that he also give them the source code for scorecard. That means they had James
Comey. So who's they? Who's they? Who's got it?
They would be FBI Director James Comey and his general counsel, James Baker, one the two most forefront of this war against Donald Trump. Yeah. And so Baker was a general counsel who took all this evidence and the source code. Mm-hmm. These are the same people that have been fighting Donald Trump since the moment he came into office. And why wouldn't they? Because they had their acts of treason.
I mean, I'm just questioning, how do we get to the part of where the rubber meets the road and get the president to do something about this? You don't really know why he hasn't come to the light of day on this story. There's enough out there about this. He certainly is aware of it, right, Mary?
Well, you just saw two generals, General McInerney and General Michael Flynn, talking about the Insurrection Act. And so when they're saying that the government must take control because the country is being stolen by domestic bad actors and foreign adversaries, can you imagine standing and tolerating Russia, Iran, China, who just paid off Joe Biden and his via his son to the tune of, we know, about $1.5 billion, or the Ukraine, you know, paying off our officials and helping them to steal an election? That will not stand in America. That the American people will not tolerate, because they're not just stealing the vote. They're not just stealing America. With that comes stealing freedom.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I don't want to fail to mention, Mary, and this is important, I think, because I was quite taken back by this. The book that Mary has out there, I believe is the title of it called The Hammer is the Key to the Coup. Is that the correct title?
That is a correct title. The Hammer is the Coup. Key to the Coup, the political crime of the century.
Now, what's interesting about this book, let me tell people, Mary, that I think is a real eye-opener, my fellow Americans, and it's this. When I discovered that Mary wrote the book and is a very serious investigative researcher and journalist here, and the work that she's done is credible, what really should be an eye-opener for everybody, guess what? That book that she references, Hammer and Scorecard, was written and released. Well, it was released back in, what was it, August, July, August or something, Mary?
August.
So this was released before the election. So just now, do your math, people. Now, this is before, I'd never even heard of Hammer's scorecard. I would have thought a hammer was something you bought at the lumber store and a scorecard would be for the sports game. I really never followed the story, Mary, so I knew nothing about it. And but you understand what I'm saying. She wrote the book before this was ever anything, before we even talked about it, before it was utilized in election 2020. Mary, that says something to me. That talks about your credibility. It wasn't like you were just trying to jump on some famous moment and get a book out there. You see where I'm at? You see what I'm saying?
This became a bestseller immediately. And let me tell you something. The reason for the title of the book, The Hammer is the Key to the Coup, is because in March of 2017, when President Trump tweeted that he was being wiretapped, we tweeted back and we wrote a piece, the whistleblower, about the whistleblower tapes that Brennan and Clapper were in fact wiretapping. General Thomas McInerney went on air with that story, but also with his longtime friend, Admiral Ace Lyons. Mm-hmm. Well, Ace came forward with the story, Admiral Lyons. So he was the head of Pacific Command, the largest command in our history. And he came forward with that story. But the important part is he died last year. And as he was in the hospital dying, the last person he spoke to was General Thomas McInerney. And Admiral Lyons reached over to his old friend and he said, Tom, the hammer is the key to the coup.
Wow, which ended up being the name of the book. Well, let me just tell everybody right now, that book we have in the America Out Loud bookstore, right off the nav bar at americaoutloud.com. You can get that a link to the book there and get it. Anyway, stay right there, friends. There'll be more Viewpoint in just a moment.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. This is not a fight of Republican versus Democrat. It's not a fight of rich versus poor, old versus young, man versus woman, gay versus straight. It's not a fight of black lives, blue lives, Hispanic lives, or white lives. This is a battle of good versus evil. It's a fight for the soul of humanity. We are the vision of the voices, America Out Loud Talk Radio. We talk about the tale of two countries is the theme today on Viewpoint, and welcome back to the program, friends. And, you know, the other big thing beside the election, the other big story in town is COVID, of course. The sad reality of this is that is beyond sad. It's disgusting. The businesses and the way this has decimated the business community from sea to not so shining sea these days, but the poor business people. And I'm talking small business people, really the heartbeat and engine of America. People that have taken a hit, their lives will never be the same. And that is something that's going to come out of this era that we're living through right now that we will not forget anytime soon here. I want to bring it right to something that you've seen some of the national stories in Staten Island here that is quite fascinating in a particular establishment there, Max Public House. But let me bring on first here, goes by Johnny Tobacco, and excited to have John on. He's the host of the nationally syndicated television show Liquid Lunch, broadcast. It's to 44 million homes on Biz TV. And, you know, it reminds me of my days in the advertising industry, John, with the liquid lunch business. But let's move it along and talk to you about that's the whole essence of that. That makes for more interesting conversation, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. That's why we say on liquid lunch, we serve it neat, a little dirty, sometimes with a twist. But one thing is for sure, it's always going to be straight up.
Oh, I love your style, brother, already, man. So I want to get right to a story in the New York Times with the headline, How a Bar Became a Symbol of Staten Island Virus Defiance here. And it goes on to say what had happened. This is Max Public House and the saloon owners, Danny Presti, is it? Is that his name?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And Keith McIlarney.
That's right.
Okay, all right. And so they have the bar that became famous because the citizens started to rally around the bar. So they have been in defiance of the governor's orders here. Tell us what's happened with this story. You've been on the front of this thing. What's happening there?
Well, Malcolm, thanks for having me. I really appreciate being on Viewpoint and getting to tell our side of the story because the mainstream media is not exactly presenting it to America as it's unfolding. I can tell you that I'm a Staten Island resident. So although I broadcast on national TV, I do a lot of local community activism. And I saw the plight of these two young men. And Malcolm, you had a great intro where you talked about the tale of two countries. And we're looking on the national level at an election that many people are not certain of. And I think almost the Democrats are trying to steal it. And there's this movement to stop the steal. I feel what's happening in Staten Island, New York, and across all New York State and the country is these progressive blue governors and mayors, they're trying to steal small businesses. They're trying to put them out of business. Mm. And these small businesses, at some point, they've exhausted all their options. They've spent every penny they could. And then you find out these guys walk into work one day and they say, you're an orange zone and you're closed, okay? And then you can walk one block away and it's a yellow zone and you can have a dinner and a drink. So the frustration level goes through the roof when people are on their last leg. They're at the end of their rope. They have no more money left. And the decision is, hey, let's go down fighting. We don't believe these orders are real. We don't recognize the governor or the mayor's authority to overreach on it like this. Mm-hmm. And we're going to take the same exact First Amendment liberties that they took in Seattle and in Oregon and other places. We no longer recognize this as a law, and they took their stand. And then I, as a community activist, said, wow, those guys need help. And I came down and I tried to lend a hand where I could. And as you know, now I am the tenant of Max Pub, me personally.
Wow. Yeah, this was incredible. You just shared this with me as we went hot here that because I seen the image of you right there with the sign. So you're actually subleasing this. Is that correct?
I entered into an agreement with the boys last week.
Okay.
They've come under a significant amount of pressure. Right. In fact, one owner has been incarcerated two different times. Yeah. And I'm referring to Governor Andrew Cuomo as Don Cuomo Leone because he's running the state like a mob boss. Okay. And what he did last week is he sent down his henchmen. He sent down his leg breakers to come here and try to put some real pressure on these guys. And, you know, when the king sees an uprising, what they do is they want to squash it. And we found out at Max's, if you're the first one to raise your voice, you get annihilated. And what happened is the people of Staten Island, who are proud people, this is Trump country right here. Staten Island, we're the outcast of New York City. We voted in the 2015 Republican primary. 83% of Staten Island voted for Donald Trump. Wow. The number one county in the entire country in the 2015 primaries. So this is Trump country. And Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio know it. So they're unfairly treating us with regard to the rest of the city. And these guys who stood up, many, many activists, Scott Lobato, Andrew Lanza, state senator, Vito Fisella, former U.S. congressman, some great attorneys, Mark Fonte and Lou Gelamino, have rallied around these guys along with the rest of our community and said, right, you know what? We're not going to take it anymore. I've sublet the place because I'm a national TV show. My business is essential. So I can be open. So Max Pub and the adjacent space next door, which was supposed to be their party room if they ever got open, is now the Speakeasy Studios. And I can be here. I can broadcast every day. I can have a live audience. I can do everything that the guys at Saturday Night Live are doing. So we're taking them on straight up, right down the middle of the fairway, safe, social distance, masks coming in and out. but we're not giving up, Malcolm.
Yeah, yeah. JT, first of all, I got to say big kudos to you, man. I'll tell you what you did to me is heroic in doing that. And I just think it sends a message here. Now, let me tell folks here, too, is what I understand now. The two partners there, Danny and Keith, they've been under a lot of fire and pressure. And we've seen some of these other gym owners that have really taken a stand as well. It sounds like Danny and Keith are becoming really more local heroes there. Now, Danny is the one who is up on charges. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yeah. But let me tell folks what's happened here, though, is you see, they've been targeted here because they've stood up. It's like, I guess I would reference it, JT, almost like a Tiananmen Square moment here in our country. Let's go, well, we're not going to have it. You could take your tank and do what you're going to do with it. But they took their liquor license away. They've pushed them and closed them down. And then there was an altercation just recently, which you probably heard folks out there on the national news with Danny, where somebody got hit and he was accused of breaking legs, which weren't broken. And there are so many pieces to this story. Is Danny going to get through this story okay? Or is he going to be in the criminal charges? Is he going to be in trouble here with the law?
Well, he's in trouble with the law. The question is this, Malcolm. Mm-hmm. The proud son of a retired NYPD patrolman. My dad was an NYPD officer, okay. And I have the utmost respect for the great men and women of the New York City Police
Absolutely.
Department. They're the greatest fighting force on earth. When the governor and the mayor want to come down with intimidation tactics and threaten people, mm-hmm. I can tell you, because I was an eyewitness to both of Danny's arrests, they sent 20 people from the New York City Sheriff's Department. Now, Malcolm, what a lot of people don't understand around the rest of the country, especially in the heartland and flyover country, that a New York City sheriff isn't like the sheriff of Mayberry, okay? The NYPD patrols the streets and goes out and finds crime and takes it down. The sheriffs in New York come out of the New York City Department of Finance. They're tax collectors. They're repossessors. They're the repo men. And most importantly, in the Bible, they called these guys the pharaohs because they come for the money, okay? Mm-hmm. And when they don't like the way you're operating, they don't send the NYPD. They send the tax collectors down here to do their dirty work. These guys are untrained. They do not effectuate street arrests. And everything that went awry is because they sent 20 untrained folks just doing their job, but they're in no position to effectuate a street arrest. And I can tell you this, I was there. There were 20 officers from the New York City Sheriff's Department. There was not one single member of the NYPD. So in the Staten Island and the New York that I grew up in, if you get arrested, that's the New York City Police Department enforcing the law. And when the sheriff comes, they don't know what they're doing. They don't follow any police protocol and try to arrest a guy in the street. He gets scared. They're wearing masks and hoodies. He gets scared. He tries to drive away. One of them tries to get in the way of the car. There's all these different allegations. They haven't proven one thing yet.
Right.
The criminal case will go forth. A tremendous amount of support is coming out from Max Pub. Danny has a huge support system around him. Yeah. And Keith McElarney, the owner and the man on the liquor license of this bar, he's a hardworking blue-collar guy. He's got a fiance. He's got 3 kids. He poured his life savings into Max Pub. They opened last December, and within 3 months, they were closed. So these guys lost everything, and maybe the mayor and the governor should take a ride down here to Staten Island and understand the pain and frustration that's happening to these small business owners, and they'd have a little more empathy in them. Mm-hmm. But instead, they just try to crush the uprising because they think in New York, the peasants have no voice.
JT, I mean, it's perfectly said what you say there, brother. I mean, perfectly. First of all, number one, I am hoping and praying for Danny that there's a path forward for him to get out of this thing, because that's a life changer right there, for sure. And with the way you position both Danny and Keith and what they tried to do, let's take that conversation outward now beyond Staten Island a moment, JT, because you talk about national politics and all that's going on on a daily basis here. And here's the concern with this COVID thing. You just put it out there perfectly and describe the moment of these guys. You see, you take guys like this. They opened a business just before the China virus came in. I mean, I always reference back to last November when I talked, JT, because last November, I mean, America was kicking ass. I mean, our economy was amazing. The president was amazing. Everything was amazing. And then this handy dandy virus comes in from China and totally changes the landscape, both politically and health-wise as well. And here we are at this moment here. But think about all the businesses. You see what's going on in California with Newsom is about as bad as Cuomo. They're two peas in a pod here. And the way they have disturbed and really destroyed people's lives, whether you had a business that's been in place for 20 years, JT, or you had someone that just opened up, like you say, last December, pour your life savings into it. I don't understand what's really going on with these people like Cuomo and Newsom and so many others. They're all over the place. And these Marxist mayors that we have that are everywhere. What is the end game? Because without tax revenue, without having the business community thrive, what are they really after here, JT? What's going on?
This is Malcolm. I'm sorry to say it, and I don't want to seem like I'm over the edge as a revolutionary or something. But to me, this is despotic tyranny. This is oppression. This is the government thinking that they know better than us. Walmart reported that they're going to pay $700 million in bonuses this year. Okay. And they're allowed to be open because they have these big lobby organizations that dump tons of money into these governors and mayors' campaigns. So they get favorable treatment. But yet the regular man who's trying to save his life savings and preserve his business is getting arrested for trying to make a couple of hundred bucks to feed his family. So it's quite scary. And the New York sheriffs and the NYPD, when Antifa and Black Lives Matter were protesting in New York City, when they were burning down our city, when they were throwing Molotov cocktails at the NYPD offices, those officers were told to stand down because these are peaceful expressions of people's right to assemble. And we're doing the same thing. So it's not a tale of two cities, a tale of two countries here. It's a microcosm of what's happening around the country. But we have a tale of two cities. In Manhattan, you could be violent. You could graffiti churches. You could throw Molotov cocktails at cops and no one gets arrested and prosecuted. In Staten Island, a white kid with a very small voice opens his bar to try to feed his family and he's thrown in jail two times in 1 week.
Yeah, no, that's it right there. You know, this whole idea where Keith went out and made an autonomous zone, that was really a very classic moment to play to the point you just made, wasn't it?
Absolutely. They're ingenious guys. They weren't trying to get publicity. They were trying to say is, hey, we're going to go down with the ship honorably. We're going to fight to the end. And they're great friends with my buddy Scott Lobato. He's a conservative artist. He paints these beautiful flag murals. He runs anti-graffiti programs by teaching young men how to paint. And Scott's friends with them. He's talking them through it. And Scott, I've been friends with for 25 years. And he said, JT, we got to get behind these guys.
Right. The only thing I can see is the people have got to rise everywhere and they've got to multiply and you've got to get these clowns out of office without getting the Cuomos and de Blasios and the Lightfoots and the Durkins and the Newsoms and Garcettis and without getting them the hell out of office, you really don't have a shot because they got the power. I mean, that's got to be the game plan, isn't it?
Well, look, this is the moment.
In
my view, the election getting stolen at the national level, and we see progressive governors and mayors trying to steal businesses at the local level.
Right.
So tell people what's coming soon to a theater near the whole country if these liberals really get in and take over this country. And the bottom line is this, Malcolm. Staten Islanders are a rare breed. We have an amazing melting pot here in Staten Island of all different races, all different creeds, all different religions. And there's one thing about us. We have a fighting spirit and we come together as a community. After 9/11, we lost over 300 people. We came together as a community. After Hurricane Sandy in 2012, we were one of the hardest hit places in all New York City. We came together as a community. We prayed together, we volunteered together, and we helped work with people. And now in 2020, when our country is literally under siege, it takes a couple of young men and a band of warriors from Staten Island to step up and say, hey, we're not going to take it anymore. We're not going to be subjects of your tyrannical rule. And if we have to question your leadership and authority to come down on us, we're prepared to do it.
Boy, I'll tell you what, my fellow Americans, I just enjoyed that conversation tremendously, tenfold, with Johnny Tobacco. I mean, JT goes by as well. The program, again, Liquid Lunch, that I told you about is broadcast on Viz TV. Just excellent voice. And this is really the passion of America we're hearing right now. And I think you sense that all the way through the program here for sure. What a terrific program and really is. But now, listen, we got the next hour, Michael Johns, and well, we are on fire there. I'll tell you that second hour of Viewpoint is coming up just next to you, Viewpoint Presents. A tremendous thank you to all of our guests here today. And again, my fellow Americans, as always, thank you for being with me on the mission. It's time to get involved and get loud.